Welcome back, folks. Recently, Louisiana judges have been criticized regarding the cost of their continuing legal education. The Code of Judicial Conduct prohibits them from defending themselves. And Ed Walters, the president of the Louisiana State Bar Association, joins us, and he'd like to present their side of the case. Ed, welcome to the show.
Hey, good morning, Newell.
So, Ed, I'll let you start off. Obviously, maybe a little background as to how many hours the judges are required to have, things of that nature, and we can start there.
Okay, good. They're required by the Supreme Court rules to have 12 and a half hours a year of continuing legal education. Five of them have to be with the Louisiana Judicial College. And something recent is that they have to have trauma training every 2 years because of all the trauma involved in handling the cases before them. One of the things that I wanted to express for the judges who, as you said, can't defend themselves is that this is a mandatory matter that they have to engage in every year. And one of the big ones that most of them do every year is the CLE, the annual summer school and judges meeting, annual meeting in Sandestin, which is obviously in Destin, Florida. And it's a great meeting because it's many, many lawyers and many, many judges from around Louisiana get together and have some camaraderie and exchange of ideas and learn from people who are experienced in certain areas that maybe we're not that experienced in. And it gives us the ability, us lawyers and judges, the ability to benefit from what other judges, other courts, other lawyers do in jurisdictions around the nation and really around the world, and putting together some specialty courts, which I'm happy to discuss with you if you want to hear about it.
Yeah, participated at Sandestin in getting my CLE hours for a number of years. I think part of the issue that I hear, Ed, from folks all the time about this is, so you have a 12.5 hours of CLE annually. I guess some folks ask, well, how many conferences are you allowed to go to in order to get the 12.5? Because in theory, a lot of what's happening here is, and then the other thing is, how many hours should the public be required to pay for CLE? Should there be a cap? You may have some judges that say, I would like to achieve 50 hours of CLE on the public dole. And I don't know that these are unreasonable requests, and it's kind of interesting, as to so your thoughts about that, whether or not there should be a limit on how many conferences you can attend in order to achieve your 12 and a half hours, and whether there should be a cap on the number of hours that is financed by the public.
I think what the real issue is, not how many hours you get, but I guess the real issue is, why do you have to go to Destin to get these hours? And, it's expensive to go to Destin to, you bring your family with you usually and spend, the whole week there. And it's rather expensive. One of the things that the news report said was that, these judges on the Fifth Circuit spent like $40,000 for CLE. But if you look closely at the information that they used, it was over a four-year period, okay? It's not $40,000 a year. It's over a four-year period that these judges did that. And the article or the news article report didn't break down how much they spent every year and where they went to get it. So I'm sure each of the courts have some sort of way to see how much they're going to pay for. I don't know the answer to that necessarily, but if there's a cap, I don't know about it.
Well, I don't think there is. I mean, you know, and that's what I hear. I hear that from lawyers as well. They're kind of curious as to why some judges are showing up at six or seven different conferences, getting 1 or 2 hours of CLE and spreading it out, and you know, and making six or seven trips out of it. I mean, if the Louisiana Supreme Court wants to get serious about this, it would seem to me that the Louisiana Judicial College should be the place that they get their CLE. Because, you know, one of the issues, and Ed, I think you know this well, we don't actually have a system in Louisiana. We have a collection of judges and judicial district courts that adopt their own local rules. You know, they decide what specialty courts they're going to have in their respective districts. So from civil defendants and criminal defendants, it all depends on what district you end up in as to what you can avail yourself of. There's no standardization at all.
Well, that's true to some extent in that in some parishes there are different types of courts that other parishes don't have. But, for example, we have specialty courts that we've adapted because we learned from these conferences from people in other states and that how they handle, you know, domestic violence issues in their courts. In some places in Louisiana have a domestic violence court. We have veterans courts, which have to go be trained how to do that. We have reentry courts, which we're trying to get people who have been in the criminal justice system and imprisoned or whatever, trying to reenter them back into society and be a good tax-paying member of society. We have drug courts, which I think almost everybody now has a drug court, which we learned how to do from other places in America that have drug courts that are very, very, very beneficial to try to deal with our drug problems and treat our people instead of just incarcerating them. And we're spending a lot of time recently with teaching our judges about artificial intelligence and how that impacts their courts and their lawyers and brief writing and that opinions and that kind of thing. But we have, like this summer at Destin, we had people come teach our judges and lawyers from Knoxville, Tennessee, Brooklyn, Louisville, Kentucky, Charlottesville, Washington, Miami, Durham, North Carolina, talking about all of these kind of issues, reentry courts, artificial intelligence, and that sort of stuff. You can get your 12 and a half hours of CLE in New Orleans, I guess, but you're not going to get the wealth of information that you get from these specialty courts to adapt our courts to what's happening nationwide. So that's the benefit of going to a place like Destin.
Look, I'm not critical of Destin. I think I agree with you. I think there's incredible value there, right? But, you know, if you're going to make the commitment to Destin, it would seem to me that there should be a minimum number of hours that you're going to achieve in Destin, right? And that you're not paying this sum of money to go get 3 hours of CLE. And then you go get 3 hours at another conference and then 3 hours at another conference and 3 hours at another one. And now you're visiting four conferences in order to fulfill the 12.5-hour commitment.
That I agree. That would be an abuse, but I'm not sure that's happening.
That's exactly what's happening. I hear it from lawyers all the time that are completely frustrated with that situation. You know, we're not getting the necessary hours of judges sitting behind a bench in court. They're stretched to the max. We're having to do more with less. And the question is whether or not, you know, in my mind, the Supreme Court should be setting rules to say that if you're going to go to a conference and the public is going to pay for your airfare or your travel or your hotel or whatever it may be, you need to get a minimum number of hours there in order for the public to be the beneficiary of the return on their investment in you. And I don't think that that's a lot to ask for. And I think there also should be a number. there also should be a number set by the Supreme Court that says the public is only going to finance this many hours of CLE. You know, and if we require more, the Louisiana Judicial College through the Supreme Court should be financing it and conducting it in Shreveport, Ellic, Baton Rouge, New Orleans, Lafayette, wherever. I think that's what the public is asking for. They react emotionally to this, but I could tell you, you know, and Ed, if you've heard it from lawyers, I'm sure they've said it to you. You know, that it's kind of ridiculous what's going on. You know, they pop in for 3 hours and they're there for 3.5 days at a conference. And what? You know, that judicial district is paying for it. And without taking a systemic approach to this, I was on one of the seminal panels to bring drug treatment courts to the state of Louisiana. I traveled. I went to San Diego. I went to Sacramento. We went to Salt Lake City. They had systems in place. We spent time there, met with folks. We did two of those cities on one trip, you know, and brought that back and was able to implement something in Jefferson Parish. But interestingly, you know, at that point in time, we were able to bring what we learned to other judicial districts. That's not always the case, and there's really not always an avenue that's set up in order to do that. I don't see a lot of value in different people from different districts going out to an AI conference, not bringing back the information or not bringing back a learned individual like y'all did in the Judicial College to talk about the trials and tribulations of AI. You know, how many different judges have to go to a conference on AI when that ought to be an issue of such prevalence and such importance that the Judicial College handles it himself and the Supreme Court should make it a mandatory attendance because it's going to impact every court.
We're all still trying to learn how AI is going to impact all of our lives, including the courts and the lawyers and the law enforcement and everybody. And so I think working along with other people who do know something about AI. I mean, these judges talk to each other about how AI was watching it when I was in Destin, how some judges, judges on the Fifth Circuit are very experienced in AI, talk to all the judges that were there about AI and learn from this judge's experience. And that's kind of what they do. I agree with you. If there's an abuse, let's go fix the abuse. I'm not sure there's an abuse. I mean, you hear things, but like this article, you know, talked about how much money, but it was over a 4-year period, and it really didn't discuss where they went, how many hours they got, and what courses they took.
But We have no one to blame but ourselves because the judges aren't willing to give the information up, quite frankly. I mean, there's no way to defend going out and getting you know, a condo unit of such size to accommodate your family on the public dole for you to go get CLE. I don't know if that's happening or not. But if it is happening, I don't know that it is or not. I don't know. I'm ignorant on that. But that's the suspicion. But we're not willing to address the elephant in the room and say, well, no, that's not what happened. This is exactly how much I paid. This was the average rate in Sandestin for one individual for a one-bedroom condo, hotel room, whatever. And these are the rule, and it should be a rule that's adopted, and that's what I'm allowed to be reimbursed. And if I want to get a four-bedroom condo, I can get it, but I'm only going to be reimbursed this.
I think you'll find, Newell, that what you just said is what's happening. People can get a room for, you know, one person or one person and their wife. But if you're going to bring your family, I don't think any of our courts are paying for extra rooms in condos for other people's families. I have never heard of that. All I know is that when they bring their family, they're all staying in that one room, or they get other rooms that they pay for.
Sure.
I don't think the courts are paying for those extra rooms. I don't think that's
I suspect that you're right, but the only way that you're going to get a fair story out there is to give them the information. Look, they've been critical of Sandestin every year that I can remember, going back to when we first started going to Sandestin, right? The beauty of Sandestin is you get people away from their office. They're not bothered. They're not leaving the conference to go drop by and sign some documents or this or that or otherwise, and to gain more of their attention and to be more proactive in what's going on in the training. I get that, and I fully buy in it. I've seen it work. I've seen it happen. You know as well as I, there are some people that take it a lot more seriously than others.
That's true.
As it relates to that, and that's an issue that you're never going to ultimately resolve, right? If they want to criticize Sandestin, so be it. But the reality is, it's a good place. They have the infrastructure to support the number of people there, and the networking and everything that goes on throughout that conference, I think, is huge. And I think the Bar Association does a great job. They've always done a great job of managing that. But I go back to, we have no one to blame but ourselves. If they think that that Sandestin is the end all of resorts, they're wrong. And if we specifically identify what was paid for, I think a lot of this issue would go away. But we play this cat and mouse game, all the time. And we have no one to blame but ourselves as well. A lot of under the campaign finance laws, a lot of these things could be financed by their campaign funds and relieved of the public dole as well. But we've become so restrictive for judges and the ability of them to raise money. These are the things that ultimately end up happening. And the public would be the beneficiary of other people's money being spent on CLE. In my mind, that's a much better, as they say in the ninth.
It's always
better.
Good to use other people's money. Yes, it's always best.
I know that the Bar Association has always been in tune to doing the right thing with that, in their participation in that conference, the law schools as well. The media has always been down there trying to find somebody in a compromising situation, whatever. I mean, I think they even took pictures of judges in weenie bikinis one year. And they thought that was newsworthy. Well, people wear what they want to wear. I don't care what they're wearing. It's like,
except they put it on the front page of the Picayune. That was a
problem. I understand. You can't control that. But what you can control is when they ask for the information, is give it to them. Show them, and that's part of the issue. I just think we need to get smarter about how we're doing this and how we're accounting for it. It's necessary. There ain't no doubt about it. Anybody that says it's not is a fool. I mean, things are changing so fast out there.
I will go look into it.
AI is a classic example, and we should have the best coming down to Louisiana by districts and educating everybody on the utilization of AI, because it could be the most disruptive force to your occupation. On so many fronts. And that's how you want to talk about existential threats. There's one.
There's one right there. You're right, Noel.
Yeah. Absolutely. No doubt about it. And I didn't mean to dominate. I just think we got to get a little smarter. And I appreciate the fact that you joined us. There are judges that do the right thing each and every day, and they never get recognized.
No, that's true. That's true. I will look into your ideas, Newell, and find out and get back to you.
Love to have you back on at any time about any issue that that impacts the Bar Association. Ed Walters, President, Louisiana State Bar. Because, Ed, I know that you're getting that big money, right, for being head of the state bar.
Exactly.
The checks are just rolling in, baby.
Absolutely. Every day I have to go to the bank. Thanks, Noel.
People don't realize the sacrifice that's made by you guys and ladies that are serving as president of Louisiana State Bar Association. We appreciate it for sure.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. We'll be right back. 504-260-1870 on the Oakland Heart Jewelers Talk and Text Line. Stay with us. Welcome back, folks. You know, there's a lot of concern about any retaliatory actions taken by Iran. We know that they have been the predominant funder of terrorism around the world. We also know that they have sleeper cells located in all kinds of different countries around the world as well. What we don't know is their intent and how they will ultimately utilize this network of terrorists that they have. Craig Wiles, adjunct professor for Tulane Homeland Security, who designed a graduate course on narco-terrorism at Tulane University, joins us. Craig, welcome to the show.
Sheriff, thank you. It's a pleasure, sir.
It's good to hear your voice, Craig. It's been a long time. How serious of an issue and how concerned should we be?
And that's a great question, Sheriff. As we know, with the recent memo that was just released by the CBP Commissioner Rodney Scott, where it's titled, "Thousands of Iranian Nationals Have Been Documented in the United States Illegally, Countless More Were Likely to in the Known and Unknown Gotaways," roughly upwards to 2 million gotaways, as a matter of fact. He reports that in this same memo, that the possibility of sleeper cells, terror domestically, has never been higher. I think the reality based on that memo was, of course, it was on the backside of the U.S. Air Force dropping the 14 bunker buster bombs in Iran. Iran continues to be probably, in our relationship, one of the most contentious and complex in modern politics. As you know, I spent 8.5 years in Afghanistan and had the opportunity to meet with a number of Iranian officials and talking about funding terrorism and, quite candidly, the heroin problem. But our partnership, although is strategic and at times hostile, we've got to keep this diplomatic approach. And with that in mind, I believe Iran feels the same way. I mean, they have a newly elected president, and I completely understand the Ayatollah controls the military, but they have a newly elected president last year who, by their standards, is a moderate. And he is probably the one that's trying to keep a level head as we move forward through this chapter. We do know that Iran uses Hezbollah, which has been is a Lebanese-founded group, but funded by Iran, who spends the majority of their time in Venezuela. And we know they have a strong relationship with Hamas. And they continue to enjoy that relationship. But even Hezbollah has come out and said, you know what, if you're going to poke the United States, the bear of the United States, we don't want anything to do with it. So I believe, sir, probably without a doubt, and we've seen this through some of the reporting of the border crossings, there are those that have made it across into the United States that have loyalty to Iran and have loyalty to Hezbollah and Hamas. We know, as an example, the border crossings over the last couple of years have been through the roof. And in fact, when I was evacuated out of Afghanistan in 2021, a number of Afghans had said to me that they were going to try to make their way to the southwest border because they weren't able to get across through diplomatic ways. And we even found with Afghans, roughly 150,000 Afghans we brought into this country, and over a dozen of them were on the no-fly list. So we've been complacent with even facilitating those individuals getting into our country.
As long as you've been doing this, I would imagine, is it safe to say that you're kind of mystified as to why we are missing the opportunities to try and gather intelligence information from individuals that are crossing the border, and that we're not more intrusive. We haven't been more intrusive over this past 4 years, and we've been fighting, you know, this issue, I think, without really focusing on what it really is all about, is the safety and security of our country. You can't just let everybody in, because we know that they have folks that are not well-intentioned, have malintent in their heart and in their mind, and would love to destroy us. I mean, that's not a reach, is it?
No, sir. As a matter of fact, Sheriff, President Obama said in June 2011, as president, I have no greater responsibility than protecting the American people. And it does. I scratch my head, having been in this business my whole life. I scratch my head over these missed opportunities and this reinventing institutional knowledge. I don't know why it's so thin that we can't for a minute take advantage of the opportunities that are right in front of us. These Border Patrol officers are some of the finest young women and men that that we have. For sure they're overworked, and for sure they're underpaid. And when they raise their hand, their efforts are to hold the line. And why don't we empower them to truly take it to the next step and ask really just simple questions that we can use as intelligence-based and develop those into evidentiary-based investigations. You're exactly right.
So, obviously, they recognize the big challenge now. I think there's been somewhere between 40 and 60 Iranian illegals that have been arrested. I got to imagine those numbers are going to increase. We don't really know how big the problem, though, is, right?
No, sir. What we do know is there were over 1,200 captured over the last 4 years, and roughly three quarters of those were released into the United States under a notice to appear type of handshake agreement. But we also don't know, based on the 2 million gotaways, or specifically the 900,000 that came from countries in Latin America that are allies of Iran, specifically Venezuela, Nicaragua, Cuba, Haiti. There's been reports that there's over 530,000 of those citizens that were paroled into the United States under a notice to appear type of program. So is there one hiding in there? We can't rule it out. For sure, we can't rule it out. We must remain vigilant and, I guess, see something, say something, right?
Well, it's the same thing with the Chinese, right? I mean, we don't really know how many of these folks have come in. But we do know that there were folks that have been intentionally planted here because we've made cases. So, you know, we know that it is, in fact, occurred.
You're absolutely right. Is it some reports from the CBP have suggested 65,000 Chinese nationals were apprehended illegally crossing into the southwest border, compared to 5,000 in 2017 to 2020. You're absolutely correct. How many of those Chinese nationals are here for ill will? We've got to assume that there is a percentage of state actors that's amongst that group of folks that are now sitting here in the United States and with no interest in doing anything good for our country.
So what do you think are going to be the next steps for CBP as it relates to this Iranian threat? I mean, we all hope and pray that the ceasefire holds firm. We hope and pray that we get through some type of or semblance of a negotiation process that reaches some goals that we hope to achieve. But we also understand the fragility of all of this, right? And we also understand the ability of the Iranian government to try and separate themselves from these sleeper cells, all the while knowing that in many cases they're intrinsically linked.
Absolutely. And to that point, listen, this relationship with Iran, we all know the timeline. Pre-1979, we were friends. As a matter of fact, as we fast forward, we see Israel shooting at military targets on the ground. They're F-14 Tomahawks. They're ours. Those were military assets that we sold to the country. So we've almost come full circle, right? So we're almost, I guess, do we look at them as the best friend money can buy, or do we continue to push through and try to hold a standard? And under this current truce, temporary truce that the president has demanded, what we have found are two countries that have taken a pause in hopes of trying to push some type of peace plan forward. I'm not sure at the end of the day that they'll ever be the pre-1979 ally that we had counted on for that region. But I don't know at this point if they have any allies in that region. We take a look at this situation, Sheriff, and we say, and the base they fired the rockets at was the base that they had evacuated all of us from Afghanistan to. So I'd spent time on that base. And they were able to intercept 13 of those rockets, and the 14th caused no damage. So a ceremonial response to the 14 bunker busters that we dropped. But for a Muslim country firing on us, the sovereignty of another Muslim country, we even see the Saudis saying, hey, enough is enough. Stop it. Knock it off. We see Qatar as well saying the same thing. And you can't help but ask yourself, when President Trump came into office, his very first international trip was to Saudi Arabia in May. And looking back on it now, does he play a game of chess? Was he telling our allies in Saudi Arabia at that time, hey, listen, I'm going to do something about Iran and Israel. Hang on. Hang tight. I don't know. But what we're seeing is the global response to Iran is to knock it off.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. I've always been concerned about these sleeper cells in this country because as they get more and more radicalized, they also become more independent from you know, the queen bee, right? Being
exactly.
Iran.
Exactly.
And you never know when they go rogue, right?
Yeah, I've got to tell you, Iran, you're right, Sheriff.
You know, and that's always been, you know, the concern. And the other concern is typically if they're going to do something, it's going to be of a magnitude that draws a lot of attention. And there are so many soft targets and hard targets available to them here.
You're absolutely right, boy. 9/11 sure changed all of our mindsets, didn't it?
Yeah, I absolutely did. I mean, you know, it's not something that I would have typically known, you know, as a local government official or law enforcement agent. But we learned fast, and
we sure did.
You know, we've been called a lot of names for locking down the border, and I said that this morning in my monologue. You know, racist, xenophobic, this, that, and everything else. But it's all about the safety and security of the homeland. You got to know who's coming to your country. Plain and simple. There are no excuses.
Simple rules.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're so right. And we have the laws on the books. Just allow our agencies to enforce those laws. Absolutely. I totally agree with you, sir.
I just don't understand why we're at odds over this issue, you know, and do we need something horrible to happen before we wake up? I certainly hope not. It's too late then.
Well,
so
it sure
we've had that experience in 2001. Right?
I mean, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. So, and listen, that was 9 terrorists, right? So, yeah. I mean, that the bread and butter behind it was simply $450,000 to fund that operation. Wasn't a lot of money, and it changed all of us on how we look at and perceive things as we move forward.
No doubt. Craig Wiles, as always, thank you so much for your time, your insight, adjunct professor at Tulane Homeland Security. We appreciate your time. Have a great week.
Sheriff, always a pleasure, sir. Good day to you.
Thank you. We'll be right back, folks. Stay with us. Really excited about the LSU Fighting Tigers being able to celebrate their successes last evening. It looked like they had a lot of fun doing so. So congratulations again. To the LSU Fighting Tigers and their success at the College World Series. If you love football, don't miss our special broadcast live from Manning Passing Academy tomorrow. Join Mike Dettillier and Steve Geller for Sports Talk Live from Thibodeau at Nicholls State University. They're going to bring you to the 50-yard line at the premier football camp in America with the first family of football, Archie, Eli, and Cooper. This camp helps players reach their full potential on and off the field by teaching the fundamentals of football for key offensive positions, running back, tight end, wide receiver, and, of course, quarterback. And this year it will feature elite quarterbacks Archie Manning and Garrett Nussmeier and a whole lot more. So join them for a special edition of Sports Talk Live from the Manning Passing Academy tomorrow from 4 to 8 p.m., brought to you by the good folks over at Thibodeau General Hospital, the Thibodeau Regional, Health System, and WWL. They always do a great job over there, and the Manning Camp always does a great job as well. And, you know, folks, we are going to continue to provide this coverage relative to this Iran-Israel ceasefire by having guests like we just had on today with Craig Wiles. We'll get updates from CBS News as the story unfolds, and that'll be Tommy, myself, and Scoot. We're talking to expert guests and a place to share your opinion. So stay informed with us at WWLAMFM.com and, of course, always on the free Odyssey app. And the beauty of the Odyssey app is we know you're busy. You can go back and listen to just portions of these interviews, whatever tickles your fancy. You can have it delivered directly to your phone free, right? And that's a beautiful thing. Or you can just tell your smart speaker, play WWL. We'll be right back. Stay with us. Folks, when we come back after the top of the hour news break, we're going to visit with Rafael Goyeneche, President, Metropolitan Crime Commission. We are going to be talking about judges' dockets. You're going to want to hear some of these transcripts as well. This is crazy what's going on in the courts. You'll scratch your head for sure. Stay with us. We'll be right back with Rafael Goyeneche.